Good evening and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, brought to you from the Cumberly Theater here in Palo Alto. My name is Hazen Jihu. It's my pleasure to introduce Ralph Nader, author of The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for Our American Future. Recognized by Time and Life magazines as one of the most influential Americans of the 20th century, Ralph Nader has been a catalyst for health, environmental, and economic issues for more than 40 years. He is one of the country's most effective consumer advocates, and his efforts have helped mobilize millions of people and set the framework for over 100 focus groups on corporate and government accountability. Ralph made national headlines when his book, Unsafe at Any Speed, initiated automobile safety laws, including the National Traffic and Motor Safety Vehicle Act. He is also instrumental in creating the Environmental Protection Agency, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, and the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration. In 1996 and 2000, Ralph was the Green Party candidate for running for President of the United States, and in 2004 and 2008, he ran as an independent. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Ralph Nader.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Hazen, and thank the Commonwealth Club and everybody here who has come to listen to a different kind of message. And the message starts out, it's a lot easier than we think to turn our country around, and a whole series of long overdue redirections that are supported by a majority of the American people now and that will raise the promise and the morale of the American people, who are extremely demoralized and discouraged about the future. They feel themselves helpless. They feel they're powerless. They're cynical about politicians, which, of course, just strengthens politicians' vulnerability to powerful corporate and other lobbyists in Washington, D.C. When I lost a lot of friends in traffic accidents as a young man, I looked into how they could have been saved. And they could have been saved by seatbelts, and they could have been saved by a whole series of engineering devices that we now take for granted in our cars, collapsing steering columns, better brakes, better tires, head restraints, padded dash panels. All of these and more were developed by engineers a long, long time ago. But they weren't applied because the companies, as some of those of you who are a little older, remember, the companies were selling style and horsepower. They weren't selling engineering integrity. And as a result, hundreds of thousands of people were killed and millions were injured in ways that today's cars, which could have been yesterday's cars, could have prevented. Now, when I went to Washington, I was hitchhiking to Washington to try to get Congress interested in holding hearings. And it never occurred to me that I could not take on General Motors and defeat them because I believed I had the facts. They were certainly understandable by people. Everybody drove. Everybody knew friends or relatives who were killed or injured. And everybody knew that American ingenuity was pretty good, that they didn't have to build psychosexual dreamboats that could kill you in a 10 or 15 mile an hour collision, because your head would hit sharp edges on the dash panel with lethal impact. And I remember I was hitchhiking once, and a truck driver picked me up right outside Delaware, and he said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "I'm going to Washington to go see some members of Congress." And he said, "What for?" I said, "Because I want to federally regulate the auto companies so they have to meet safety standards." I thought he was going to let me out of the road right then and there. But you see, I never exaggerated the power of these corporations because if you exaggerate their power, and they are powerful and they know exactly what they want to control the environment of their business activities so that they can make more money and get more bonuses and perhaps give more dividends to their shareholders. And they do that in a very strategic way to this day. They strategically want to control the environment. that they operate in. If the government is part of the environment, they want to put their officials in high positions in government. They want to contribute campaign money to members of Congress. And if consumers are potential drag, then they want to have more exciting, emotional advertisements and try to get them to buy their cars. And if the labor is considered an obstacle, well, they'll try to make their influence known there. And if they don't want to pay a certain level of taxes, they will shape and strategically plan the tax. And if they want to have members of Congress who are receptive to them, they will enter through their executives and political action committees the campaign cash that is needed. And if they want the engineering schools in our country not to be too curious about why automotive engineering was never risen to the level of a PhD, it was all civil or mechanical, and if they didn't want MIT or Caltech to research the lack of safety engineering design in cars, well, they just give a lot of money to MIT or Caltech. And I saw that personally when I was trying to get engineering help for my work on unsafe at any speed. But I never exaggerated their power because I had a very, very realistic view of the power of people. And I realized that corporations, for all their power, they don't have a single vote. And that what members of Congress wanted were votes. And so if people became alert and they began to realize that it wasn't always the nut behind the wheel and crashes and injuries on the highway, that the engineering systems of highways and vehicles were very critical in minimizing crashes, and if they occurred, minimizing their injuries, such as a seatbelt, then the public interest would prevail. Now, that served me pretty well because I had my feet on the ground and I knew I had a lot of work to do. I had to get the technical community behind what we were doing. I had to get it out to the media. I had to have contacts with senators and representatives who remembered where they came from and had a pro bono publico in their mind. And I had to have some contacts with the White House. All that happened. And we got more done in 10 years on the consumer, environmental, and worker safety front, on the freedom of information front, on support for science and technology for the people in terms of pushing for more benign forms of energy, pushing for detection instrumentation to detect coal dust levels in mines, for example, pushing for safer automotive technologies, aviation technologies. And in doing that, I thought we were going to really go to the next level. And what was the next level? The next level was to have full health insurance for everybody, nobody out, everybody in, with free choice of doctor and hospital. That would have saved about 1 million American lives in the last 20 years. Where do I get that? The Harvard School Medical School study showed, and this was a peer-reviewed study in the Journal of American Public Health, December 2009, that because people could not afford health insurance to get diagnosed and treated in time, 45,000 Americans die every year, 800 a week. Completely preventable. Nobody dies in Canada or Japan or Taiwan or Germany or England or Sweden because they don't have health insurance. That could have been accomplished by a Democratic Party as good today as it was in the 1960s. It wasn't that great, but by comparison, it was much better. And a Republican Party that had some liberal elements in it in 1960 compared to today's draconian conglomeration of political ignorance, arrogance, stupidity, and cruelty in Congress. So, I can footnote all this if we had time. Now, the first thing we have to ask ourselves is, can 1% of the American people, 1 out of 100, let's say 3 million people, organized back home where you are in Congress watchdog groups to steer Congress along a whole line of redirections that a majority of the people support? A majority of the people support full Medicare for all, including a majority of doctors and nurses. A majority of people support raising the minimum wage to levels of 1968, adjusted for inflation. It would be $10 now an hour. It's federal, 7 1/4, a little higher here in California. A majority of people want law and order against corporate crime, fraud, and abuse, whether it's Wall Street style or Houston style. A majority of people want a tax system that does not provide perverse incentives, horrendous complexity, waste of our time. A tax system that starts with the principle that we should tax first before we tax labor, that which society likes the least or dislikes the most. So we should first tax pollution. Even Exxon prefers a carbon tax. We should tax speculation on Wall Street, which has reached horrendously frantic levels, and computer-driven derivatives, $700 trillion last year, And there's no sales tax here in California. What do? You go buy any furniture or clothes, you pay what, 7-8% sales tax? Tomorrow somebody can buy $100 million of Intel derivatives and pay not a cent. That's not fair. We had a transaction tax in this country in 1905, and it was in the 30s under Roosevelt. And then for a variety of reasons, it was phased out. But do we really want that kind of speculation? No. So one way to do it is to tax it. At 0.5%, and other countries are thinking about this too, and Japan already has one, a small one, 0.5% will bring in $300 billion. Isn't that preferable to taxing work? Or you should tax corporate crime more. We should tax addictive products more. Things that we don't like, we should tax before we tax labor. Things that we presumably like, which is work. A majority of the people don't believe in unconstitutional wars against countries that don't threaten us. And 70% of the American people, even though the propaganda is on the other side, and we don't have an opposition party that is on the side of 70% of the American people, won out of Afghanistan yesterday. Even though both parties were complicit, but mostly the Republicans, in invading Iraq under Bush Cheney on a platform of falsehoods, deceptions, and cover-ups, which are now part of American history, incontrovertible, half of the country was against it. Just in their own intuition, their own, what are we doing? Iraq doesn't threaten us. It's run by a frightened dictator surrounded by a dilapidated army who we supported to invade Iran years ago and who was our ally because he was anti-communist, and we'd give him lists of suspected communists who we'd slaughter. He was surrounded by much more powerful neighbors. Why are we invading? I mean, people figured it out that way. Some of them, half of them, 300 retired generals, admirals, national security officials, famous diplomats, including Jim Baker and Brent Scowcroft and Marine General Zinni and the head of the former National Security Agency, Bill Odom, spoke out and wrote against invading Iraq before it happened in March 2003. A majority of the people in this country think that there's something inflated about our military budget. They've read the Pentagon audits and the GAO reports and the 60-minute exposés and so on. It's horrendously inflated. Waste, fraud, abuse is only part of it. We're still building cost overrun military weapon systems designed for the Soviet Union era of hostility. Like the F-22 should never be built. You could put it on this stage. That's how much $200 million of electronics costs, profit, and overruns. Why are we building more submarines, nuclear submarines? One Trident submarine, nuclear warheads, can destroy 200 cities. That's before it reloads. Why are we building more aircraft carriers? $15 billion a carrier. We got 13. The next country to challenge us is Italy, has two. It's the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us against. People don't like that. They'd rather have that money go where Eisenhower wanted it to go in his famous Cross of Iron speech that you can look up on the Internet, April 1953, when he said, is this the way we want to live? We can wipe out the Soviet Union? They can wipe us out? And then he did what no other president did. He listed how much a bomber cost, a tank cost, a cruiser cost, and translated it into schools and clinics and public transit systems and hospitals. A majority of the people think Congress should have skin in the game. This is one which I almost got unanimity on when I was campaigning. I said, how many of you think, since Congress likes to buck it over to the White House about getting us into war, they don't want to deal with Article 1, Section 8, which gives them the exclusive right to declare war. How many of you think that any time Congress and the White House want to plunge us into war, constitutionally or unconstitutionally, that immediately all able-bodied and age-related children and grandchildren of all members of Congress are drafted? See? That will tend to concentrate their deliberations on Capitol Hill with thorough hearings by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the House Foreign Relations Committee, and some of those retired military and diplomat security would have been up there with all the media to transmit their views back to the people. How many people here think that we should have civic training courses and civic experience for middle school and high school children all over the country? You know, physical education is being dropped all over the country. Our children are getting fatter and fatter. They're getting more diabetes. They are getting demoralized. It restricts their potential in life at a young age. They're predisposed to high blood pressure. They're being exposed by electronic child molesters called food processing companies, teaching them how to nag their parents at a very young age to buy junk food, to drink junk drink, while they're watching violent programs that show them how to kill. A colonel who used to teach at West Point, Colonel Grossman, was so offended by these child programs and vicious toys that he wrote a book called Teaching Our Children to Kill. Do you know any parents that aren't bothered by that? Do you know any parents who want to have their children exposed to clever ads that nag them? That's the word that's used for prize-winning ads toward children on Madison Avenue. It has a high nag factor. How about restoring our civil liberties? You think the majority of the people don't want arrests without charges? Throwing people in jail without lawyers, many indefinitely, invasion of your privacy, going to your librarian and finding out what books you signed off on. And if the librarian notifies you, the librarian can be criminally prosecuted under the Patriot Act. You think a majority of the people want government to be able to invade your home without a warrant and not have to tell you for 72 hours? There's a huge consensus in this country on things that matter when you get down to specifics where they live, work, play, pray, sleep, and raise their children. It's when it's at the abstract level of ideologies that the polarization exists, and those are promoted in order to control people, divide them against one another, divert them. You know, I sometimes meet conservatives who say, we're against government regulation. I say, do you have a car? Yeah. What if the company discovers a serious defect, like a sticking throttle, for a million cars and doesn't tell you? And all of a sudden, your cars are going through other cars and trucks and walls. Do you think the government should force them to do it? Not many people would say, absolutely not. We want the freedom to go through a windshield. You think the American people don't want a law enforcement expansion on corporate crime, fraud, and abuse? If you learned how few prosecutors there were in the Justice Department against environmental crimes, you wouldn't believe it. Last time I counted, it was 78. 78 lawyers. Can you imagine all the pollution laws that are not being enforced and being violated? Just the water permit laws, for heaven's sake, are chronically violated by water polluters. You know, the double standard in corporate crime is really almost beyond belief. Did anybody, any of you see this documentary that won the Academy Awards? I'm sure some of you did. Here we go. It's called Inside Job. Well, you must have seen the Academy Awards. California. Okay, well, the producer, Charles Ferguson, he won the Academy Award for Best Documentary in 2011. He goes on the stage and he said, the audience is a billion people worldwide. And he says, quote, 3 years after a horrific financial crisis caused by massive fraud, not a single financial executive has gone to jail, and that's wrong, end quote. Now look at the contrast. In December 2007, Roy Brown, a 54-year-old homeless man, walked into a Capital One bank in Shreveport, Louisiana, without a visible weapon and told the teller to give him money. The teller handed him three stacks of bills, but Brown took only a single $100 bill. He said he was homeless and hungry. The next day, he surrendered to the police voluntarily, telling them that his mother hadn't raised him that way. He pleaded guilty. You know what he got? 15 years in jail. 15 years in jail. Happens all over the country. The big boys get off. We are under-enforcing the criminal justice laws against corporations. There's no three strikes and out for a corporation. No three strikes and out. There's no probation for a corporation, hardly ever. And the executives, they have shields of law firms to defend themselves. And it's getting worse, because there were several hundred saving and loan executives prosecuted, convicted, and sent to jail 20 years ago. And some Enron executives were. But they have so gamed the system, the corporate lawyers, it's extremely difficult to put them in jail. And by the way, if they went to jail, they would improve the prospects for prison reform. and the food would be better. The governments buy almost everything we buy. You know, it's called government procurement. They buy food. They buy clothing. They buy motor vehicles. They buy energy. They buy construction materials. And they can do specifications where they can stimulate innovation. And we got airbags that way. The auto companies controlled Department of Transportation under Reagan, and we couldn't get airbags. So I went over to the General Services Administration, and I said to the administrator, who luckily happened to be a rigid Republican from New Hampshire, and he was an auto supply dealer. Now listen, if you know anything about auto supply dealers, auto parts dealers, they have no awe of the auto companies in Detroit. So I said to him, you buy 40,000 cars a year for federal employees. He said, yeah. I said, how would you like to save some lives and some money? He says, how? I said, just specify next time you procure these cars and put them out for bid, airbags. He did it. And GM knew what was coming, because once the GSA gets airbags in cars, their ball game is over. They're going to have to provide it to the public. So they refused to bid. Chrysler refused to bid. Ford bid on 5,000 vehicles, and the rest is history. You now have airbags that can prevent you from exerting your freedom to go through a windshield. Okay? So, people say to me, look at all the things you've done. This is unbelievable. I said, don't make me out as a freak. You can do the same thing. You can have the same passion. You just want to do it. Somebody wants to win the Olympics, they work night and day to train. Someone wants to be a great poet or a sculptorist, they work hard to do it. And if we want to be an effective, strategic, successful citizen advocate, you work on it. You read history. You learn the lessons of the people before you who won and how they won the struggle against slavery and women's right to vote and civil rights and the farmer populist victories and the victories of industrial trade unions in those horrific dungeon factories in the late 19th century. You learn from them. You learn why our founders used the word posterity again and again. And we don't use that word anymore because we're too short-sighted as a society. We want it now. The corporations want it for the next quarterly report. The politicians want it for their next report on how much money they've raised. So the idea that ordinary people cannot become extraordinary citizens is nonsense. It's a lot easier than we all think to change it. How do you turn the country around? Well, where do you start? You start where the lever is the most physically effective, and that's the U.S. Congress. The Congress has the tax power, the spending power, the war declaration power, the confirmation of nominees power, the investigative power, the power to say no, the power to say yes, affects us all the way down to our stockings. Congress is made up of 535 men and women who put their shoes on every day like you and I. They want our votes. 1,500 corporations get their way with a majority of the Congress these days. They have no votes. We're the ones who have the votes. But we don't work at it. Half of us don't vote. Most of us don't do any homework about our incumbents, so we really can't critique them. And we allow them to flatter us, fool us, and flummox us. And boy, are they good flatterers. If you ever meet a politician who doesn't flatter the people, I'll show you a visiting Martian. So, how do we do it? We start out by having a training session. You know, you want to learn how to play mahjong, poker, video games, you know, bridge. You got to learn the rules. You got to develop skills. So we have training sessions. Nobody can stop us. Right in our neighborhoods, neighborhood training sessions, community college adult education, whatever. Simple. You can do it over the internet. We learn how to lobby. We even learn simple things like, how do you put on a news conference? How do you use the Free Information Act? How do you develop coalitions? How do you confront depression, political depression? People getting discouraged, people getting burnt out. How do you elevate their morale? How do you get them to get rid of this mindset of you can't fight City Hall or you can't take on Exxon? We have historical antecedents for this. The next thing you do is you guarantee to your senator and representative an audience of 300 people, and you summon them to an agenda entitled The Subordination of Corporate Power to the Sovereignty of the People. Excessive corporate power and what needs to be done. Even Business Week believes there's too much corporate power, and they live off corporate ads. You realize that so few people show up, and half of democracy is showing up at marches, city council meetings, courts, demonstrations. So few people show up that if you can show that you're going to put 300 people in an auditorium like this, or a high school auditorium, you will get your senator on this stage in person and a representative. And once you got them there and you're summoning them and you're informed, you got all kinds of informed people, economists, accountants, engineers, technicians, community organizers, graphic artists. Who's got this poster? Right here? Okay. lest you graphic artists among you, you want to see how I can get your attention of your member of Congress? You get the names of all the corporate interests that got their hooks in them. It's all public. It's all on the internet. You get the graphic artist to draw the senator, and then you put a jacket on the senator or representative, and then you put the logos, depending on the size of the contribution, all over the jacket, like a NASCAR race, okay? So we did it for the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, who is the nemesis of the Democratic Party. And guess what? The Democratic Party so disrespects Democratic voters in his Southwest Ohio district that they did not field an opponent this year. He's running unopposed. Okay? Here's John Boehner. I don't know if you can see it, but afterwards you can look at it. Do you realize what it does to a politician to present him with something like this? Huh? These are the interest groups who own him. Sallie Mae. He was the main opponent for student loan reform for years, and a very powerful one. Look, it's on the sleeve, Sallie Mae. Now, you got 300 people here, 300 people there in the district. The district has 650,000 people. And pretty soon, you've got the numbers to select for 1,000 serious members of a Congress watchdog group. And this happens all over the country, 435 districts. Every district has talent. Every district has community college, four-year college, a lot of talent. The 1,000 people put themselves behind an agreed agenda. I mentioned some of these, the living wage and full insurance and so on, war and peace. They agree from the beginning, so they don't have to bicker so much. They agree to devote 200 hours a year. Volunteer, 200 hours a year, 4 hours a week. They agree to raise or contribute $200 a year. And they open an office with two or three full-time staff. And then they summon their members with an agreed upon national agenda of long overdue redirection supported by a majority of the American people, what Abraham Lincoln called the public sentiment. When he said, with the public sentiment, you can do anything. Which is why I say 1% of the American people turning Congress around, turns the executive branch around, turns our priorities into humane and productive paths, reduces the level of corrosive greed, and on and on. We become a humanitarian superpower instead of a military ravaging empire. On and on. Do you know how fast the Congress would turn around? You couldn't count the days. You couldn't count the days. They'd be so stunned with all of these Congress watchdog groups coming at them in so many strategic and technical ways and reaching out. And they know that this group has a majority behind them. That's how fast we can turn it around. And in many areas, if you don't do the reforms fast, you'll give the opposition time to game the system and delay. Harry Truman proposed universal health insurance in the 1940s. We still don't have it. We got regulation of the auto industry 9 months after Unsafe at Any Speed came out in November 1965. I'm not talking from political theory here. I'm talking from experience. I've never seen more public demoralization. I've never seen more Americans give up on themselves as citizens. I've never seen people so pessimistic that their children are not going to do as well as they are, and the future looking so grim. I've never seen them elect more ignorant and stupid people who have taken their power and sold it for what used to be called a mess of pottage and is today called campaign contributions, and then turned that power against the very people who gave them that power under our representative form of government. 25% of the Congress today would support this agenda that I described. 25. That's a pretty good start. And once they see the support from back home, they will become your tribunes with their colleagues on Capitol Hill. Now, let me put it very specifically. Justice needs money. I know a lot of progressives don't like that. They like to do God's work with no money. Every social justice movement in our country of significant magnitude was funded, with the exception of the labor movement, by rich people. Rich Bostonians and New Yorkers funded the abolition movement, including supporting Frederick Douglass, who came up with one of the greatest civic insights of all. Quote, power concedes nothing without a demand. And if we are so shorn of any morale that we don't even demand anymore because we've given up on ourselves, why should the power brokers give us the time of day? Especially when they got two parties dialing for the same commercial dollars. So here we go. You'll never hear this type of proposal. Ready. Justice needs money. The environmental movement was funded before it became a membership base by a few rich people. The early civil rights movement, heavy funding from the Stern Fund in New Orleans, the Curry family in Virginia. The women's suffrage movement was slowing down until some rich women helped fund it in the 19th century. A small portion of very rich people, especially in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, where they have a different perspective on life. They want to look their grandchildren in their eye. They're thinking of not wanting to leave this country, heading for the cliff. They can do a tremendous contribution by funding these justice movements. I even wrote a book on it called Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. It was political fiction, but it had a lot of reality. So, for example, George Soros could have backed up those hundreds of retired military, diplomatic, and national security people, quadrupled their number in 2 months if he put $200 million behind them to stop the invasion of Iraq and to stop and expose the lies of Bush and Cheney in the 9 months before March 2003. George Soros was vigorously against the war. He gave interviews, he spoke, and he wrote. He didn't make the connection that it needs money to back up with an infrastructure for these people. $200 million for George Soros can be compared with a reasonably good year when he makes $3 billion. Ted Turner, for example, can vastly increase the peace movement. We've heard of waging war. What about waging peace? What about anticipating conflict? What about not exaggerating criminal gangs and following up with massive invasions, blowing countries apart, and spreading the criminal gangs into 22 countries? Al-Qaeda. What about spending ourselves into penury in terms of deficits and the $3 trillion over the next 30 years that Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize laureate, said the Iraq war is going to cost us? Not just the immediate war and all that, but all the follow-ups of the veterans and so on. Bill Gates Sr. and the famous trial lawyer in Texas, Joe Gemayel, could easily fund reopening our courts so ordinary people can use them, so ordinary people who are wrongfully injured can have their day in court and not be blocked by what is maliciously called tort reform, by taking people's age-old rights of having a trial by jury away from them. They could open up the courts to poor people, because Bill Gates Sr. has made that one of his missions in life. He's a corporate lawyer, but he made opening up access to justice one of his missions in life. Warren Buffett, he's worth now $52 billion. For $1.25 billion, I can show Warren Buffett in 3 years, maximum, how to completely transform the tax system. So it is an efficient, fair source of revenue without inequities that exist today and the perverse incentives that distort investment into unproductive channels. What is $1.25 billion for Warren Buffett? He gives $3 billion a year to the Gates Foundation, on whose board he serves. I've had rich people, very, very rich people, tell me, we know how to make a lot of money, we do not have a clue what to do with it, and that includes us. So if we want to be very practical about it and speed things up, if we know very rich people, and Silicon Valley has a few of them, recognize the following, that a lot of them could care less. They want to make more money, or they're in their little gadgets. It's amazing how much brain power is being poured on technical changes and innovations of minimal significance. Just look at the apps lately. I mean, they're embarrassing as a culture. People can find ways to save millions of lives and not make anywhere near the amount of money as some little quiggly app for some idiotic whim that is promoted. Okay? But there are people in Silicon Valley, you should try to bring them together for a dinner. I would be glad to attend. Who I can show can leave a legacy with their head so high that it would reach the sky. Because the country's ripe. We're a country that has so many problems we don't deserve and solutions we don't apply. And that's the democracy gap. And to get it changed, we need field organizers, we need media, we need expenses. And these billionaires, without having to persuade them, you go where their own sense of justice is already indicated, like Buffett on taxes. He thinks he should not pay a lower tax rate than his secretary. We can show them how it can be done. Now, this comes from many a year of going into the corridors in Capitol Hill, in the office. I know their psychology. I know their vulnerability. I know how they can be shamed. And I know how they can be led to hold their head high as well. Let me just end on this note. Some of you try to get people out to meetings, marches, demonstrations, city council meetings. You phone them, you email them, you beg them. You're not trying to change their mind. They agree with you. They just are otherwise preoccupied. And so you know what the four excuses of civic abandonment are, don't you? The first is when you ask them, well, why don't you come out with us? Why don't you be engaged? I don't have time. If they have time, the second excuse is, I don't know the rules. I don't know what to do. These are people who know complex video games. These are people who know how to fix things. These are people who know how to read the tax code. And they're telling us they don't know about Robert's Rules of Procedure in a town council meeting. Well, if they have the time and they're not daunted by learning some of the rules, they say, well, I don't want to get myself in trouble where I work. If I'm seen as a troublemaker, I won't get promoted, and I don't need that. Well, if they're not blistered by moonbeams, what's their final excuse? This is one I can't rebut. The excuse is, well, I have the time, I know what to do, and I don't care about being controversial, but I can do it and nothing will happen because the big boys will decide. Now, that's the prescription of dropping out of democracy. That's the ultimate surrender, and we should try to avoid that with our friends and our neighbors. Because in so many ways, if we don't do it for ourselves, we have to do it for our children. And in so many ways, this concept of fair play, where people live and work, and the concept of the golden rule, which is transcultural, bring people who are divided at abstract ideological levels together in the pursuit of what Senator Daniel Webster many decades ago called justice, which is the great work of human beings on earth. I'll leave it at that for a discussion. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Good evening. And I'm just delighted to have this conversation with you, Mr. Nader. And welcome to all of you this evening. We are going to have a conversation, and then we're going to open up to questions that you all have submitted. So let's just kick it right off now. When I told my friends, Ralph, that I was going to interview you tonight, the most frequent response I got was, Ralph Nader, where has he been? What's he been up to? So where have you been, and what have you been up to?
See, if you're not on the evening news, you're not on national media, they don't think you're doing anything. We have never stopped. We start new groups. We foster all kinds of proposals. We try to disseminate information. We lobby Capitol Hill. We never stop. I mean, if you want to see what we're doing, you want to get my weekly column free, just go to nader.org and sign up and look back over the years. It's been 40 years now. You see what we're working on. And all the groups that I founded, I like to spin off so they're autonomous and they're on their own 2 feet. And there have been over 100 of these groups.
Fantastic. So we're coming up now on a presidential election. Mm-hmm. What is your prediction for the presidential election, and are you going to vote?
First of all, I always believe in voting. I don't ever publicize my vote. I believe in the privacy of the vote. The election now is basically, it's a two-party duopoly. They don't like competition. They exclude third parties from debates, which commission is a corporation they control. And so I think that the differences on foreign and military policy are de minimis. Difference on corporate policy, not much. The Democrats have better rhetoric. There are differences on Social Security and Medicare and civil rights. I don't think there's that much difference on civil liberties. Unfortunately, the Democrats have degraded in that area very seriously. So my guess is that Obama will probably win. Biden was going at it on the way with Paul Ryan. And I was just amazed at how unimaginative the questions were. I mean, just to give you one quick example, when Paul Ryan was indicating his solicitude to the poor, this is one of the cruelest budgets ever proposed, if not the worst in American history. Biden, because mum's the word, the Democrats have decided that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, one of his cardinal achievements, the 1938 federal minimum wage law, was never to be discussed in this campaign. Elizabeth Warren is not allowed to discuss it. Joe Biden is not allowed to discuss it. George Miller doesn't discuss it publicly. He put in a bill under our stress just for pro forma, never had a press conference. Nancy Pelosi doesn't discuss it. Richard Trumka of the AFL doesn't discuss it. And the minimum wage today, adjusted for inflation, as I mentioned, would put tens of billions of dollars at 10 bucks an hour, tens of billions of dollars in people's hands to jumpstart further a recessionary economy. Biden could have skewered Ryan, and he was muzzled because Obama does not want to discuss this because he might be accused of being against small business, who he's given 18 tax breaks by his own admission on the first debate, 18 tax breaks. And two-thirds of all low-income workers are employed by 50 large corporations like Walmart and McDonald's, whose CEOs get an average of $10 million a year. I mean, you'd think this was a slam dunk, but it isn't. So I think our presidential politics are rancid, repetitious, cowardly, and commercialized. So whoever wins, don't expect that much.
Okay. So, Ralph, you've run for the presidency a number of times, and so let's just hypothetically, if you were, in fact, elected and you were president of the United States, how would you deal with the extreme partisanship of Congress? How would you break the gridlock if you were in the White House?
Just go straight to the people. You know, the president is known to get good media. You know, you barnstorm the country around a let's say, for convenience sake, a 10-point agenda of redirecting our country. Like I pointed out, you'll see the partisanship melt in favor of political survival on Capitol Hill. You know, that's you're supposed to be a president of all the people. Go to the people. The people are sovereign. The Constitution starts with we the people, not we the corporation. And you will see how fast that happens. You know who did that? Bill Bradley did that. He went all over the country as senator from New Jersey, generating support for tax reform in 1986. And it was a fairly good piece of legislation, which Ronald Reagan endorsed. But he hit the hustings.
Well, didn't President Obama do that with health care? Wasn't he out there beating the drums?
But the wrong kind.
What do you mean?
He wouldn't further what he said he believes in, single payer, full Medicare for all, because he said, quote, it's not practical, which is another way of saying, I can't take on the supremely popular health insurance companies and drug companies, right? So he wasn't worried. As a result, his system will not restrain the enormous costs that are increasing. It'll leave 30 million people still uninsured after it's fully implemented, and it's so complex that it opened itself up to attacks and parody by the Republicans. You know, the Canadians got full health care for everybody. They do it on half the cost, $4,500 per capita a year. We spend $8,500 per capita a year, 50 million people uncovered. Our Obamacare is 1,500 pages. Do you know how long the Canadian Medicare bill was? 13 pages. The more complex, the more waivers, the more exceptions, the more the more it can be gamed, delayed, twisted, misapplied, nullified. So I always knew Obama back in Illinois. He had a personality that's conflict-averse when it comes against power. He doesn't care about people who support him. He'll turn his back on people who support him because he's got them for granted. If he's conflict-averse, he's not the president that we need. You have to have the president take on the corporate power brokers and their corporate law firms and their PR and their cash-writing arms. If you don't, how are you going to change Washington, which is corporate-occupied territory?
All right, another question. All right. So you have authored, I believe, 11 books. And I've read two of them. I've read your 17 Solutions, and I've read the 17 Traditions. What's up with the number 17?
Well, when I wanted to write how my parents raised their four children in a factory town in Connecticut, in the Depression and during the war, World War II, I ended up with 17 traditions. Hmm. And they're basically how they raised us. It's all the problems all families have. How do you get your children to eat right, not to fall in with the wrong crowd, to respect their parents, to do their chores, you know, things like that. And I reached 17. And so they called it 17 Traditions. Now my publisher, HarperCollins, is hung up on number 17 Solutions. I told him I either have a lot less or a lot more solutions. But if you want 17, okay.
So let's talk about changing the system through civic engagement, and that's really the core of your 17 solutions.
Yeah, exactly.
So the case in point I want to talk about is mine.
Yes.
I ran for the Palo Alto City Council in 2004, and in taking a stand against campaign financing, I refused to take any monetary donations from anybody.
Oh, my God, thank you very much.
So in doing so, I had to then develop a grassroots organization, and I did win a seat on the city council. So thereafter, I won, and nothing has changed. So in subsequent city council races, Palo Alto, Bay Area, those running for city council, they're out raising a bunch of money, going to people, getting the donations. So what did I do wrong?
Because you didn't win the votes on city council?
I won. I won the election, but I didn't change the way people are running for elections, meaning I didn't take any money, but people are out taking money.
There's two ways to win an election. One is to be a good candidate and be very persuasive and win like you did. And another is to mobilize people so you win from a mass movement. Because once you have a mass movement, two things happen. You get a mandate, so you don't forget where you came from, but you signal to your competitors that there are going to be other mass movements in their bailiwick the next time around. But if you win sort of solo, because you're a good person and you're articulate, you don't have that kind of mandate. The last major reform movement in America, the most major, was the populist progressive one in the late 1880s. And they elected senators and governors and mayors, almost a president, over the next 20 years. And it's because they came out of a mass movement. And these representatives, for the most part, delivered because they came out of that movement. They knew that they couldn't face that movement if they betrayed them. So that's really what I would suggest. You have to be elected with a lot of people, not from a lot of people.
Got it. So let's talk about another aspect of this, of we the people, and about the initiative process. Now, it's my understanding that the initiative process was initiated by we the people. It was basically an effort by people to take back government from wealthy people, and really the initiative process started in Idaho, of all places, where the railroad barons were pretty much paying off legislators. So we have today the initiative process that I think has primarily become the tool of the wealthy. A rich person gets an idea, pays people, gets the signatures, and gets whatever he or she wants on the ballot, oftentimes poorly drafted. And I tend to call it the initiative industrial complex, basically. I think that's what we have in California. So what do you think about the initiative process, and how do we, the people, take the initiative process back?
Well, as you know, it was Governor Hiram Johnson, great gift to the people of California. I wish we had that in Connecticut, where I come from. And we had a little experience with that in Prop 103, the Auto Insurance Property Casualty Reform Initiative 1988 that we advocated here, because your auto insurance premiums were among the highest in the country. And we had $2 million to spend. The insurance industry hurled $80 million against us, TV ads and so on, and we beat them. And there are about $80 billion less money you all have had to pay in the ensuing years. Why did we beat them? One is we went up and down the state. It was a real grassroots effort. Harvey Rosenfield and others were involved. Second, the media covered it every day. The media covered it every day, and especially the Los Angeles Times. And third, it was something everyone understood when they write their auto insurance, you know, check. So it wasn't complex to understand. So it is true. The corporations have twisted grotesquely this initiative right that you have against you. I mean, even the tobacco companies blocked one recently, didn't they?
That's right.
It's supposed to be a little higher tax on tobacco. Tobacco is not very popular these days. But they twisted it because they dominated the airwaves with their propaganda. Okay, so campaign finance reform. If you want to have an honest initiative referendum recall process, you got to have public funding of public campaigns. Otherwise, you will get this grotesque takeover of the initiative process, not all of them, but of that will basically demoralize everybody. You say, look, this is direct democracy, and the corporations have taken it over. Now, there have been some great wins in California in the last 30, 40 years by the people through the initiative process. There's a great one, Prop 37. It would be, if you win it, the first labeling of genetically engineered foods in the supermarket. And that has major consequences beyond your right to know that are beneficial in the future. Prop 30 restores some of the taxes, tiny bit, on the wealthy. Governor Jerry Brown is trying to get through. Otherwise, there's going to be some serious further cuts in Cal education and tuition hikes and so forth. So there are some good ones, but if people don't do their homework, they can't nullify some of that money against them, because they'll be vulnerable to propaganda, to that 30-second ad. But if they look at that booklet, what's that called, that booklet for the initiatives?
The election guide?
Yeah, the election guide. If they spend some time, just studying it, they got the pro and con, it's a way to insulate themselves from this 30-second propaganda barrage that hits the airwaves.
Well, we're going to have, we only have 10 minutes to take questions from the audience, and I've got a lot. So I'm going to ask a favor of you, which is to, if you can, keep your answers brief.
And I'll go 20 if you'd like.
Well, I'm looking at my timekeeper here. I had a rule in my court for lawyers, the three B's, be clear, be brief, be seated.
Okay.
So you're already seated, so just be clear and brief. We're ready to go. All right, first question. What is the most significant ideological issue on which you have changed your mind over the course of your life?
The draft. I was against the draft. Now we have a professional army. It is flattered by the politicians who send it into illegal maneuvers abroad and invasions. And that was a mistake. I think we should have the draft, and because there'll be too many people drafted, they will go into 2 years public service. Even William F. Buckley supported a public service for people who are young people who are 18. I think when you're part of the risk, you're going to be part of the solution.
Right.
Our founding fathers did not want a professional army. They were very explicit about this. They called us, we did not want a standing army. And the moment we get awe and a tiny number of people go to fight when they shouldn't be sent to fight because, quote, they're a professional army doing their job, the moment we have that awe, we surrender to that kind of militarization of our foreign policy. And having been in the army, I can assure you that when you're in the Army, Navy, Air Force, or Marines, you don't have awe of those people when you get out because you know too much.
Second question, what are the most important questions you would ask the presidential candidates in the next debate?
How will you shift power from the few to the many in ways that make it very easy for people to band together as consumers, as workers into democratic trade unions, as small taxpayer groups, and as communities who are being abandoned by corporations under government policy and tax benefits to send the jobs to fascist and communist regimes abroad.
Compound and complex. New York was home to three teams, the Giants, the Dodgers, and the Yankees. The Giants and the Dodgers were known as the people's team. The Yankees were the elitist team. What possessed you to be a Yankees fan?
First of all, whenever you're a Yankee fan and you're a little boy, you're a little boy forever. And I was a Yankee fan right after Lou Gehrig died. And I learned a lot about stamina by knowing about Lou Gehrig, you know, his, you know, constant playing, his constant game attendance, which he set a record until the Baltimore Orioles broke it. Player Cal Ripken broke it. And I grew up in the era of Joe DiMaggio and Mickey Mantle. And when Steinbrenner came across, it sort of soured me. And I lost interest pretty much. But I'm still 10 years old when it comes to being a Yankee fan.
All right. Why do you think Elizabeth Warren was not given the position of head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau?
Because she was too good for the job. My father once said, the only way you lose your job in government is to do your job.
There you go. All right. What advice would you give to someone having a child in 2013?
Is there a reason for the year?
Just meaning now. It could be now.
I mean, this is not a Nostradamus question.
No, no. Don't know. Probably not.
Okay. This is the
there
advice.
These
are my parents. We just wrote them down from time to time through their comments in a cigar box, which all children should do for their parents and grandparents, because there's huge wisdom and experience over a period of years, and it'll be forever lost to history, to our larger society, and to your children and grandchildren.
It's a lovely book, and I just read it this weekend, The 17 Traditions. Thanks. What is the chance of developing a true progressive movement in this country, one that can be impervious to money?
If enough people will it, it happens. If they organize the 1%, it will happen. It takes people with the same determination to do what your question is directed, that people indicate when they join a serious birdwatchers club. I'll settle for that level of intensity. Nobody can stop people from doing it. The other answer to your question, if you get a very enlightened billionaire who is a progressive billionaire and runs for the presidency, writes out a check for $500 million and turns it into a three-way race. Ipso facto. The press covers him or her because they're rich. The polls cover him. They can't keep him off the debates. Three-way race. Break the grip and get people used to voting for alternative candidates.
On reflection, what are some takeaways you have from your campaigns for president?
One is, a takeaway is dozens of lawsuits against us by the Democrats to get us off ballots. And we've documented all that. And it's very important when a two-party system has fangs to make them bring those fangs out publicly. So they're not hiding behind a myth of democracy and competitive elections. And the other thing is, I've never seen people convey to me their sense that they've lost control over everything that matters in their life, including their children. They've lost control over their government. They've lost control over their big employers. They've lost control over their schools. They just feel they've lost control. And that's, of course, we campaigned to combat that. But that was a very deep feeling. And that's what we got to turn around. That's what we got to turn around. And that's what I wrote this book, 17 Solutions, for.
So we've got one more minute left. What are your thoughts on the impact of social media today?
I think it's great to tell people what's going on, events. It's great to get information. Its Achilles heel is a susceptibility to massive, overwhelming gossip and trivia between parties. It hasn't proved yet, except a little bit in the Occupy Wall Street, that it can take people from virtual reality communicating with each other into reality, showing up as human beings with other human beings, and is the only way to motivate people is person to person. Cannot be done through electronics. You can perhaps tell them about it. You can inform them. That motivation comes from small gatherings growing into large-scale movements. All change starts from one or two people and small communities. There's a great book by Arthur Morgan, the former head of the Tennessee Valley Authority under Franklin Roosevelt. He went all over the world to find out what could start change. His answer, small communities.
This conversation has been wonderful and far too short. I am now at the time where I have one final question for you, and it is this.
Can I just interject one thing?
Absolutely.
Those of you who want to extend this discussion, our website is essential.org, essential.org, and you can get my column, as I think I mentioned, by going to nader.org, and you get it every week. And if you want to broaden out, connect with citizen.org for many of our other groups in health and energy and public interest litigation and so forth. Right. Citizen.org. You can see how early we got that domain name.
Ready for the last question. All right. In 1988, you appeared on Sesame Street, and you were a person in the neighborhood. And you were involved in a little controversy on Sesame Street. And could you tell me what was the controversy?
Well, the controversy, they wanted me to say, I'm the consumer advocate in the neighborhood. I had to say that 50 times to get just the right inflection. Taught me something about linguistics. And they used the word who. And I thought the proper word was whom.
And so my understanding is that there was that pushback and finally Sesame Street, and you're the only person for whom they have done this. They changed the word in the song and allowed you to say whom instead of who. So if that is true, seeing is believing. So we close with an encore of Ralph Nader's famous Sesame Street appearance from 1988. Just watch.
Hey, what do you think? I'm making sure the wheels on this wagon were put on right. We wouldn't want anyone to get hurt.
Gee, that's very nice of you.
It's my job. My name's Ralph Nader. I'm a consumer advocate.
Oh, hi. Nice to meet you. Hey, you're the guy with the great memory, right?
Memory?
Yeah, I understand that you have total recall.
No. I'd like to recall that joke.
Well, he's the guy who checks to see that things are all made properly. If something's wrong, he makes a fuss. He's an advocate for all of us.
I like your sweater, though.
Oh, thanks very much. My Aunt Myrtle made it for me.
Has it been tested?
Tested?
Has it been made properly?
I don't know.
No problem. I'll do it for you.
I think it's probably just fine.
Better safe than sorry. But you check. Pocket check. Sleeve check.
This is terrible.
I know. Your Aunt Myrtle knitted you a lemon.
Listen.
I'm your neighbor. It's a person in your neighborhood,
a person whom you meet each day.
I forgot that entirely.
So I thank you, Ralph Nader, the consumer advocate in our neighborhood. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you. That was a nice
You're awesome. Stay there. You stay there. You're awesome.
Thank you.
Clearly, you've enjoyed tonight's program. Thank you very much. Brought to you by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Ralph Nader, author of the 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for the American Future, and our moderator, retired Judge Ladoris Cordell, our audience here in Palo Alto, and everybody joining us on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened conversation, is now adjourned.